Last time we lectured, we ended up talking about the roundworms, and we were talking about different species of roundworm, at least some parasitic species of roundworms. And I want to talk about two other parasitic species of roundworms. And the first is Nicator americanus, which is the New World hookworm. There's actually an Old World hookworm as well. But hookworms are found in essentially warm, moist environments. They're very common in the southeastern and southeastern part of the United States. These hookworms are not as common today in the United States as they once were. At one point in the history of the United States, some scientists predict that maybe as many as 90% of all of the people in the southern U.S. were infected by hookworms. Okay. That may be where we get the idea of hillbillies, people that are lazy and don't want to do anything except for lay around and drink all day, right? What happens is these hookworms actually, as adults, live in the digestive tract of the human host. Eventually, once the eggs are released, if there's not good sanitation facilities, these eggs can be released out into the environment. Now, before the 1900s, of course, there wasn't good sanitation anywhere in the United States. Basically, everybody had an outhouse, and if you didn't quite make it to the outhouse to go to the bathroom, you know, or you were out in the woods, you went. And another thing that contributed to this large infection rate by hookworms was not a lot of people had shoes, especially in the South. Kids would go without shoes, and so would adults to some extent. And what happens is the larval stages of these hookworms have a little tiny hook on them. And if you come in contact with them with your skin, they'll actually hook onto the skin and then burrow through the skin and into the circulatory system. And once inside of the circulatory system, the way that they mature is by feeding on blood cells, especially white blood cells. And when you have low white blood cell counts, you feel what? Tired, lethargic, sick, okay? And so this is, you think it maybe as many as 90% of people in the South were infected by hookworms. Kind of gives you an idea as to why we think of people from the South as being lazy, you know, hillbillies, those types of things. Probably it was mostly because many of them were infected with hookworms. You can actually, there are medications to deal with hookworms nowadays. But it's still a fairly serious problem in some parts of the world, especially undeveloped parts of the world. The last group of worms that roundworms I want to talk about is the Wicheria. That SPP means that there are quite a few species within the genus Wicheria. These are sometimes what we call the filarial worms. They're not found in the New World. They're mostly found in the Old World and. Again, in kind of warm, semi-tropical environments. Immature stages, they actually have a complex life cycle, and during the immature stages, they're found in aquatic environments. If you come in contact with one of these worms, they'll actually burrow through the skin again, but where they survive as adults is in the lymphatic system. I don't know if many of you know about our lymphatic system, but our lymphatic system, the main job that it does is it drains fluids from appendages, okay? So when we pump blood, say for example, to our foot, what happens is when the blood gets in capillaries, some of the fluid in the blood, especially water, gets pushed out of the circulatory system and into the surrounding tissue. And what the lymphatic system does is it collects that fluid. And then it has a separate system that moves that fluid back up and then dumps it back into the circulatory system by our heart. Okay, probably all heard of lymph nodes and so forth. They're kind of cleansing parts of the lymphatic system. But many times these filarial worms will establish themselves in the lymphatic ducts and areas on the appendages that are further away from the main body than where that blockage is can get fluid filled. And it causes a condition that is known as elephantiasis. Okay, I have some pictures of some elephantiasis infections. This leg here has a lot of fluid in it. You can see kind of why they would call it elephantiasis. It kind of makes the foot look like an elephant's foot, I guess you could say. But this person, that his leg or her leg is never going to be the same. Even if the filarial worm is removed with operations, there's permanent tissue damage that has occurred with this individual. Okay. This is one of the more severe cases I've ever seen. This is actually a picture from Indonesia. You can see the elephantiasis in this fellow's feet, and his arms, and this is a scrotum right here. Okay. This particular fellow has elephantiasis pretty bad. As you can see, he's kind of leaning on some crutches or something like that. Yeah.
How long does it take the arms and legs to get that big?
It varies, usually a few weeks.
So can't we catch it in the beginning stages?
Well, even if you catch it in these countries, most of the places where you find this, they're kind of third world countries. Really the only way to remove them is surgically. And even if you do remove them surgically, even when you first start catching them, so to speak, there's still some permanent tissue damage that's done. So if you were in one of these countries, picked up a filarial worm, they were able to remove it, you'd probably have to wear support hose the rest of your life to deal with the tissue damage. So it's not an easy problem to fix, and there's no medication that I know of that you can just take and get rid of the filarial worm. Any questions about the roundworms? Okay, the next phylum within the kingdom Animalia then that we want to talk about is the phylum Mollusca. The phylum Mollusca are what we sometimes call the mollusks. They include organisms such as your snails and slugs, octopus, squid, cuttlefish, clams, oysters, all right, that group of organisms. Now the phylum Mollusca, we're going to talk about three classes within the phylum Mollusca. And actually one of the classes, the cephalopoda, which includes the squid and the octopods, some textbooks now are actually classifying it as a different phylum because there's going to be a lot of differences between the other mollusks and that one class. However, most textbooks still classify them as the same phylum, and the reason why is all mollusks have a tissue layer that surrounds their body that is called the mantle. Okay. And you can see this is a drawing of a mollusk here. You can see the mantle cavity here, but the mantle is this structure right here. The mantle in many instances can produce a calcareous shell, and so a lot of the mollusks will have shells. There are quite a few mollusks, however, who do not have shells. So that mantle cavity, or that mantle, is the distinguishing characteristic of the phylum Mollusca. Some other things that are different about the mollusk versus the other organisms that we've talked about so far. These organisms are triploblastic and coelomate. Okay, so this is the first phylum we've talked about that has coelomate, that has a body cavity. In addition, these organisms have protostomate development. We talked about deuterostomate versus protostomate development. So this is the first group of organisms that really has protostomate-like development. Okay. Other characteristics that we might see as evolutionary advances. In the one class, their cephalic region is greatly reduced, namely the bivalves. Which are the clams and the oysters. In all of the other mollusks, the cephalization is actually much more complex than any other group of animals that we've talked about. In the bivalves, they're basically sessile filter feeders, and so it's an evolutionary digression. They don't have much of a cephalic region. Notice that they do have a complete digestive tract with a mouth and an anus. Okay, now we saw that with the nematode worms, but notice what's happening here. Within this digestive tract, we're starting to see some complexities occur. They have a digestive gland, they have a stomach-like structure, they have small intestine. And so instead of just being a straight shot gut like we saw in the nematodes, these organisms actually have modifications in the digestive tract. Okay. Any questions about that? So that's a huge evolutionary advance. Now why is that such an important evolutionary advance, those complexities in the digestive tract? Well, if you think about it, you have to eat less food. If you can more completely digest your food, you have to eat, then you don't have to eat as much food, right? Okay. So you don't have to spend as much of your life looking for food, feeding, those types of things. And that can increase your lifespan because you have more time to look for predators. It can also help in reproduction because you have more time to look for mates, and those types of things. Typically in mollusca, there are separate sexes as well. So there's separate males and females. And most mollusks only reproduce via sexual reproduction. Okay. Also, one other thing that has allowed these specializations in the digestive tract to occur and other specialized structures that we'll talk about is that these organisms are coelomates, so they have a body cavity. So this digestive tract is an independently functioning organ system, which we haven't really seen before in the previous organisms that we've talked about. Notice in addition that we see a structure here that we've never seen in any other animal up to this point, and it's a gill. What are gills used for? Respiration, exchange of gases, right? And so now this is the first organism that we've talked about that has a distinctly separate structure that is responsible for exchange of gases with the nematoda, the platyhelminths, the cnidaria, and to some extent the periphera. Gas exchange occurred by simple diffusion, right? Okay, there wasn't a specialized structure that was made to help in exchange of gases. Okay, notice in addition, there is a separate system here called the circulatory system that has a heart. Okay, by the way, what is a heart? Okay, heard a pump and a muscle. Actually, that is not the technical definition of heart. Our heart is also a muscle and does pump. But hearts, their main function is they are blood reservoirs. Okay? If you think about your body, where is the most blood in your body? It's in your heart, right? Okay. And in many of the more primitive animals, such as the mollusks, the heart does not beat or pump. What happens is there are muscles that are located right here in the circulatory system and here in the circulatory system that actually push the blood through the circulatory system. In addition, most mollusks have what we call an open circulatory system. Open, what's the difference between an open and a closed system? Obviously those are two opposites, right? We actually have a closed circulatory system. What that means is that the blood is always in some sort of a structure in our body. If you think about it, our blood goes from our heart to our arteries to our arterioles to capillaries to venules to veins and back to our heart, right? Okay. So our blood is always in some structure. In many of the mollusks, they have an open circulatory system. And so what happens is the blood is just pumped out into the coelom. Now, this is more efficient than not having any circulatory system at all, but it's not as efficient as a closed circulatory system. And the reason why is some of these areas where the blood may gather in the coelom may get an eddy, for example, in the blood, and there may be parts of the body that don't receive oxygen on a continual basis like you would find in a closed circulatory system. Okay? Any questions about an open circulatory system? Okay. So let's look at the different classes within the phylum Mollusca. As I mentioned, there are some major differences between the different classes of Mollusca. The first is the class Bivalvia. By the way, the classes within the phylum Mollusca should be relatively easy for you to remember because their names actually means something that you can interpret. Okay, so bi means what?
To Two, and so it has two valves or two shells, okay? So these are what we sometimes consider to be the clams and oysters, right? The class bivalvia are different from the other mollusks in a couple of respects. First of all, for the most part, they are sessile filter feeders. They can move a little bit, but not a whole lot. And because they have evolved as sessile filter feeders, one thing is that they don't, one evolutionary digression that has occurred in the bivalves is that they don't have very much of a cephalic region. Their head is very reduced. They don't have a lot of sensory structures. You don't see eyes on this organism, right? You don't see antennae or anything like that. And so that's one of the big major differences between the bivalves and the rest of the mollusks. Okay. So this is a freshwater bivalve here. This one's actually one that's called abalone. You only see one of the valves here, and abalone are kind of different because they're actually bivalves, but they actually scrape one of the shells off, okay? And so they only have one shell over them, even though they are truly bivalves. The next class that I want to talk a little bit about is the class Gastropoda. The class Gastropoda includes the snails and the slugs. Now, gastro, what does that mean? It's like digestive system or stomach. So the actual name means stomach what? Poda is foot. So their stomach is their foot. Does that kind of make sense with snails and slugs? They use their stomach as their foot. And so the gastropoda, its class name is kind of self-explanatory as well. Now the difference between snails and slugs is typically snails have shells and slugs do not. Okay. So this is your typical terrestrial snail. Now with this organism, you'll see that there are quite a few differences between the gastropodes and the bivalves. What's the biggest difference that you can see there? Yeah, look at the cephalic region. You can actually see some eyes and antennae, sensory structures, and a distinct cephalic region. They actually have the gastropodes have a tongue-like structure. It's not a true tongue because they can't move it, but it's really spiny. And what most gastropodes feed on is they feed on algae and funguses. So they'll actually scrape, for example, the rocks in a pond or something like that. The gastropodes are actually very important for humans. We don't eat them very much unless you eat escargot, which is snail. But most of the time, or the reason why they're so important to humans is because they're the intermediate hosts of many of the parasites that infect humans. So organisms such as flukes that have a complex life cycle, the main intermediate hosts are the snails. And that's true with many of the parasites that infect humans. The snails are intermediate hosts in the complex life cycle of those parasites. Okay. This is showing two snails that are mating. You can see the copulation occurring here. This is one that's called a conch. If you read Lord of the Flies, you've heard about conches before. How many of you have read Lord of the Flies in high school? About half of you. Half of you didn't have good English teachers. I think that's a must read for readers.
In
Mantine,
no way.
I actually had it when I was at Mantine High.
So.
This is a slug here, okay? It's a terrestrial slug. Some of the there's actually some slugs that are marine slugs that are very colorful. Another name for the marine slugs are the nudibranches. Okay. Another common name for the marine slugs. Some of them are actually quite colorful and quite beautiful. These next few pictures are pictures of some sea slugs or nudibranches. You can see they're really neat looking. Any questions about the gastropoda? The last class is the class cephalopoda. The cephalopoda include your octopods and your squid, as well as your cuttlefish and nautilus. Now, the class name, cephalo, means what?
Head.
head, and poda means foot. So if you think about an octopus, it doesn't look like it has a big old head and then a bunch of tentacles or feet. Okay. Therefore, the class name cephalopoda. Actually, that's not true when you look at a cephalopode. This is a cuttlefish, and this is also a cuttlefish. Now, most of you would say, well, it looks like this part's the head, and then these part are the tentacles or the feet, right? And actually, the cephalopods have a little bit different body plan than most other animals. This is their head. This is what we call a visceral mass, which is really all their guts and everything, okay? And then these are the feet. So if our body plan was the same as the cephalopods, our head would be right here, okay? It's basically how they're put together, all right? The cephalopods are quite a bit different from the other mollusks in many respects. As I mentioned before, some scientists actually classify the cephalopods as a different phylum now because they are so different. Well, before we talk about those differences, realize that many of the cephalopods, there's actually only one cephalopod that produces a shell. Most of them do not produce a protective shell. But the things that make the cephalopods really different, two main things. First of all, they have a closed circulatory system, whereas the rest of the mollusks, we said, had an open circulatory system. The second thing that really distinguishes the cephalopods from the other mollusks is that they have a very complex brain, very complex sensory structures in the cephalic region. In fact, the cephalopods do have the largest brain and the most complex brain function of any invertebrate animal. Okay, so animals without vertebra or a backbone like we have, they are the most complex. They have the most complex brain, and in fact, they can even learn. Okay, now what is learning? Okay, to some extent, it's memory. Okay, it's remembering what's in the past and then being able to what? Act on that memory. Does that make sense? Okay. And so cephalopods actually have some very complex memories, especially the octopods. The octopods have a very large brain, and some of them have very complex learning patterns. The classical experiment to show what complex brains they have is if you have an octopus in captivity in a fish tank, let me back up. Most of the octopods are predators as well as most of the other cephalopods. And what they prey on fish, typically. And so if you take and you starve this octopus in a fish tank, or you don't feed it for a while, and then you put some food, say for example some aquarium fish in a mason jar with a lid on it, and put that into the fish tank, the octopus will try almost anything to get that mason jar open. If you take another mason jar, it has to have fish in it, however, and you slowly unscrew the lid, the octopus can learn how to unscrew the lid of a mason jar, and it can remember how to do that over a long period of time. Okay. Pretty complex, right? Probably the most complex learning I've ever heard of with cephalopods, I was actually watching Animal Planet one night when I was up with my little babies, and there was this fellow that had a lot of saltwater fish tanks in his house. That was kind of his hobby. And some of the saltwater fish, they're over $1,000 to buy them. So they're really expensive, especially some of the tropical fish. Well, one day he comes home from work and a couple of his tropical fish are gone. And he thought somebody had come in and stole them, so he called the police. They come in, fingerprinted and everything. Couldn't find any foreign fingerprints. And had lost a couple $1,000s worth of fish. The police said, well, maybe they might come back for your other fish. And so what you ought to do is you ought to install some motion sensor cameras, if you really want to find out who it is that's stealing it. And I actually had this on the Animal Planet, the actual footage from these motion sensor cameras. What they saw was this. He actually had a tank with some octopods in it. This one octopus, there was a little hole kind of at the base of the fish tank. It would reach its tentacle out and push the lid button and lift the lid up, crawl out of the fish tank and up into the up onto the other fish tank, open up the lid, crawl inside, get some fish, crawl back out. What was really interesting is as it crawled out, it reached up, latched the fish tank shut, and then it would crawl back into its own tank and then reach up and latch its own fish tank shut. So that, you know, in any, at least in my book, that's fairly complex learning process, right? And the way that it learned to do that was it has complex eyes, so it can actually see really pretty well, and it was able to see this its owner do that. Okay. This is an octopus here. There's only one group of cephalopods that do produce shells, as I mentioned, and that's the nautilus. This is a cross section through a nautilus shell. You'll notice it looks a little bit different than a snail shell because it has these little compartments in it. When a nautilus is in its shell, it's only out in this end part of the shell. And so basically there's no part of the animal that's in this part of the shell. Okay. So as it grows more shell, and then it grows a little compartment, and it only lives in the very terminal compartment of the shell.
Do the octopuses have to be in the water to live? I mean,
they can survive for a while outside of water, especially some of the smaller ones. Another thing about an octopus is they have really strong jaws because they're predators. Some of the larger octopods, like this one here, this one probably has tentacles that are 7-8 feet across, right? Their jaws are so strong, if something like this were able to bite you, probably has enough force to like crack the bones in your arm. Okay. And some of the octopods also produce, with their salivary glands, they produce toxins, so they can be what we would call poisonous. Okay. This is a full nautilus shell here. Okay. Any questions about the phylum Mollusca? The next phylum, then, that we want to talk about is the phylum Annelida. The phylum Annelida are sometimes what we call the segmented worms. Now, when most people say the term worm, they think of, like we said, a nightcrawler. And the nightcrawlers belong to the phylum Annelida. Okay? The worms that belong to the phylum Annelida include the marine worms, the terrestrial segmented worms, and then the leeches. Okay? Those three groups of worms belong to the phylum Annelida. Now I'm going to talk about three classes, as I mentioned, within the phylum Annelida. The first class is the class Oligochaeta. The class Oligochaeta are your terrestrial segmented worms, so something like a nightcrawler. Right? So we're going to talk about some of the characteristics of the nightcrawlers, and then we'll talk about how the other classes differ from the nightcrawlers or terrestrial worms. But most of the characteristics that we talk about with the class Oligochaeta will apply to the other classes. Okay. Now the first thing that we notice about the segmented worms is that they do have body segments. Okay. Segmentation of the body is actually a very important evolutionary advance. Okay. Maybe the most important evolutionary advance that we see in the annelids. The annelids are triploblastic coelomate organisms, just like the mollusks, okay, as will be most of the animals we talk about from here on out. They do have protostomate development. But again, probably the most important evolutionary advance that we see in the segmented worms are the segments of the body. Now, segmentation is so important because what it does is it allows the animal to have more complex movements and more precise movements. Okay? If you think about our body, where do we move, or where do we have really precise movements? Where there's segments, right? If you look at my finger, there's a segment here, and one here, right? I have a segment here, my wrist, a segment here. And if you think about the places where you can move very, very precisely, it's where you have a lot of segmentation. Now the reason for that is that if you think about the body, let's use my arm since it's a little bit bigger. This muscle right here, where is it attached to? Anybody know? It's actually attached to these two bones down here. Okay, it's not attached to this bone here in this part of the arm. Why is that? because actually what it's going to do is when it contracts, it pulls my forearm up. Does that make sense? So if it were attached to this part of the bone, it wouldn't pull anything. And so when you have segmentation, the muscles actually attach across the segment. And then you can also have what we call antagonistic pairs of muscles. This muscle here actually pulls my arm in the opposite direction, okay? And it's actually attached to the bones on this side of my arm, okay? So you actually can have antagonistic pairs of muscles. You can have rotational movement because there's something to pull against. If all you have, the reason why this part of my body doesn't really move is because there's nothing really to pull against, right? Okay. There's no segment to pull against and to actually move. Does that make sense to everybody? So segmentation allows for much greater and more efficient movement. Another reason why segmentation is so important is because certain segments of the body, when you do have segmentation, can be specialized for certain functions. So you can have more precise functionings of certain parts of the body. For example, in our body, there's one segment right here, our head, that's separated from the rest of our body, right? And it's specialized for sensory structures. We also have some other segmentations, like our hands, that are specialized for picking things up and for holding things. Our feet are very similar to our hands, but they have a different function, right? And so when you have segmentation, you can have certain segments that are specialized for a particular function. Okay? That's the second reason why segmentation is so important. The third reason why segmentation is so important is because when you have segmentation, you can sometimes isolate injuries to prevent death of the entire organism. Now, there are some segments that's not true of. But let's say, for example, I were to run my hand through a table saw. Okay? Wouldn't be a good thing, right? But would it kill me? Probably not, because I could what? I could put a tourniquet on my arm, right? I may lose my hand. I may have to sacrifice some segments, but the rest of the body can still survive, right? Now, if you have an injury to important segments like your thoracic segment, then, you know, you might still die. You can't isolate injuries in some segments. But in many segments of the body, you can isolate injuries and prevent death of the entire organism. So segmentation is... Yeah, go ahead.
I said there's a kid at Maptide that did that this year, and he's almost getting filling back into it. They had to, like, stitch on this finger and all those together.
Yeah, they reattach them. They're able to do that now. We'll talk about another thing that probably this person has done a little bit later on with leeches. But segmentation, then, allows for better movement and more efficient movement. It allows for specializations of body regions, and it allows the organism to have some injury, but that injury typically, or may or may not cause permanent or death in the organism, I should say. Okay. Any questions about segmentation? Now, if we look at the other characteristics of the earthworm and the annelids, they do have a complete digestive tract. The complete digestive tract does have specializations. For example, in the earthworm, they have a crop and a gizzard. The crop is actually a marvelous evolutionary advance that we haven't really seen before. What the crop is it's a storage structure. Why is that such a big evolutionary advance?
Anything to do with cutting half and both sides to move?
No. Yeah, if you have a storage structure for food, you can eat, and you find a good food source, you can eat lots of food and then store it up, and you don't have to eat for a while. You don't have to look for food, right? So you can do other things like going and finding a mate, or, you know, seeing the sights, or whatever it may be, right? Okay. The crop is an important evolutionary advance. The gizzard in the earthworm is very similar to the gizzard in a turkey or a chicken. It actually is muscular, okay, and they swallow rocks and so forth. And what the gizzard's used for is those muscles actually contract around the rocks and so forth in the gizzard. And what it does is it smashes the food. So it's a way of having mechanical breakdown of food. Now we have mechanical breakdown of our food, right? We should. What do we call them? Our teeth, right? Okay. So they don't have teeth, but they mechanically break down their food. The food is digested chemically. Chemicals are also released in the gizzard and in the intestine, which help to break down the food chemically. Then the nutrients from that food are absorbed along this long intestine here. Okay? Any questions about that? Another characteristic that all annelids have, including the oligochaetes, is they all have a closed circulatory system. So again, an evolutionary advance, right? A third characteristic that all annelids have is they all have a dorsal brain about right here, and then they have a ventral nerve cord. Okay. So if we actually have a dorsal brain and a dorsal nerve cord, right? Okay. So their brain is found on top here at the anterior end, and then runs ventrally the rest of the body. So it'd be like if our nerve cord ran down our belly. Okay. You'll notice that one of the major differences between the earthworms and the other annelid worms, so one of the things that makes the oligochaetes different, is notice they don't have any complex sensory structures in the cephalic region. You don't see eyes or antennae. Why have earthworms evolved without eyes and antennae?
Underground.
Yeah, as they're burrowing through the soil, if you have eyes, dirt's going to get in your eyes, right? And your antennae are going to be broken off. And so they evolved without those sensory structures. So that's one of the things that makes the earthworms very different. The other thing that makes the earthworm very different is they actually have a little band on the anterior end of the earthworm called a clitellum. This thing right here, okay? And the other annelid worms don't have that. You can tell, however, that there's a distinct anterior and posterior end to this segmented worm, right? They actually look different, even though you don't see eyes and antennae on the anterior end. Right. Any questions about that? Now, earthworms and all oligochaete worms, I should mention, another characteristic that oligochaetes have is they have these little structures along the body called ceta. They're actually appendage-like structures. They're not segmented, so we don't call them true appendages. But they're actually found along the body, and they use them to help move. If you've ever felt an earthworm before, if you've never felt one, run your hand backwards down an earthworm, and you can feel the little pricklies on it. Those are the ceta. Now, the clitellum is actually used for two different reasons. One is the clitellum serves as a defensive mechanism. When you pick up an earthworm and start playing with an earthworm, what does it do to you? Okay, it wiggles around you, but it also, have you ever noticed they slime you? Okay, that slimy stuff is produced by the clitellum. Okay, you ever tasted that slimy stuff? Next time you get an earthworm on your fingers, you gotta either lick it or lick your finger afterwards. It's pretty nasty tasting. And what it is they secrete it. They secrete this slimy type of substance, and it kind of helps animals not want to eat them. Not only does it taste bad, but, you know, slimy stuff in your mouth is not the best texture to have in your mouth. Okay. The second function that the clitellum has is it helps in reproduction of the earthworms. Earthworms have both male and female reproductive structures in the same organism. Fertilization is very similar to what we talked about with the platyhelminths. You can see these two earthworms lined up opposite one another. The clitellum will produce a kind of a substance that kind of holds the worms together, and then they produce a cocoon. And what happens is they don't have any copulatory structures like a penis. What happens is they actually, as they're backing out of the cocoon, they both deposit their sperm and their ova into that cocoon, and then cross-fertilization typically occurs. They can reproduce hermaphroditically or by self-fertilization. Sometimes they'll just produce a cocoon and back out and leave only their own sperm and own eggs in the cocoon. Okay. So, any questions about how they reproduce? Now, heard Sean mention this, and probably all of you are wondering, can you cut an earthworm in half and get two new earthworms? I mean, how many of you have heard that before? Okay, over half of you. Is it true? Okay, look at the structure of the earthworm. Could it possibly be true?
No.
In other words, they do have the ability to regenerate, and that's where that tale or urban myth comes from, whatever you want to call it. If you were to cut an earthworm right here, it could actually regenerate the back half of the worm from the front half. But the back half of the worm couldn't regenerate the front half of the worm. Does that make sense? And the reason why is because of the brain, the crop, the gizzard, all of these specialized structures that are found in the anterior part of the worm. Okay? So they do have powers of regeneration, but they don't have the ability to just split into and produce two new worms.
Well, how long, like when you're fishing, how do you cut them in half, how long will they stay alive like that?
Sometimes hour, depending on the conditions. The next class within the phylum Annelida is the class Polychaeta. Boy, I misspelled that. It should be P-O-L-Y. Polychaeta. The Polychaeta are the marine worms. Okay. The marine worms are typically found in intertidal areas. Sometimes you can find as many as 100 or 200 marine worms in a bucket full of sand out of an intertidal area. Do all of you understand what we mean when we say intertidal? I think we've talked about this before. Areas between high tide and low tide, kind of right along the shoreline. Okay. And these polychaete worms actually feed on dead and decaying organic material, as well as protists, plant material. They're kind of scavengers in all reality. Now this is a polychaete worm. Just looking at the polychaete, what makes it different from the oligochaete? Okay, it has what looks like to be legs. These are actually not legs, but what they are is they're outgrowths of the body wall. They actually use them like legs, but they're not segmented, so we don't call them legs. We actually have a term for them. They're called parapodia. So, and then on the ends of the parapodia, they actually have ceta out here, very similar to the oligochaetes. So the parapodia make them different. One thing you can't see well in this picture is they actually have sensory structures on the head. Some of them will have eyes, some of them will have antennae, some of them will have palps. So that makes them different from the oligochaetes as well. And then also you see something that's absent about right here. What is absent? The clitellum. Okay. So those characteristics make the marine worms different from the oligochaete worms. So this is a close-up or a drawing of a polychaete worm. Notice the parapodia here. Notice the sensory structures in the cephalic region. Those are the two things that really make the polychaetes different from the oligochaetes. They still have closed circulatory system, dorsal brain, ventral nerve cord, complex digestive tract with crop and gizzard. Okay. This is a picture of a marine worm called a sea mouse. These long hair-like structures are actually ceta at the end of the parapodia. They're just really long ceta. Any questions about that? The last class we want to talk about in the phylum Annelida is the class Hirudinea. The class Hirudinea are your leeches. Okay. Now there are a couple of things that make the leeches different from the other annelid worms. The Hirudinea or leeches are all parasites. In other words, they feed on a larger host typically. Okay. And what they feed on is they feed on the body fluids of that host. Typically, it's a vertebrate host, snake, fish, human. Okay. This is what they call a giant Mexican leech. It's one that's used for medicinal purposes. I'll mention that here in just a minute. Here you can see the leech that it's actually filling with blood from this human here. Now, when they do feed, they can store large amounts of fluid in their digestive tract. Would you expect leeches to have a gizzard?
No.
No, why not?
Gizzards are used to crush things. Do they need to crush their food? They don't, right? Because it's fluid. So what happens is instead of having a crop and a gizzard, what they have is they have outgrowths of the digestive tract. So here's going to the anus here. And they have these outgrowths of the digestive tract that are called ceca. And so here's the mouth, here's the direction of the food. So they're able to store large amounts of body fluids within their body. In fact, most leeches, if they're long-lived species, they only need to feed maybe once every year or 2 years. If they're a short-lived species, they may only feed once in their lifetime.
Wouldn't the blood clot in there, though?
That's a good question. The blood does not clot in there because of a substance that they spit into the organism before they feed. We've talked about this before with mosquitoes when we talked about malaria. When they first attach to a vertebrate host, what they do is they'll spit an anticoagulant in. The anticoagulant is actually called Hirudin, therefore the class name of Hirudinia. Okay. And so if you pull a leech off of you, you'll bleed for a while. That's because there's anticoagulant in your circulatory system. Here's a leech on a human leg. I'm assuming that it's a male human leg, but you never know, right? Here's a leech on a fish. Here's the leech right here. This aquarium fish is probably going to die because of that leech. So sometimes they can have serious effects on their hosts. Now, leeches can be used medicinally. There are a couple of different places where leeches are used medicinally. One place is with amputations, where they reattach an amputation. One thing they'll do sometimes is they'll actually put leeches on either side of the structure that's been amputated, like a finger. And what the Hirudin does in the sucking action of the leeches actually causes the nerves and the blood vessels to grow across the amputation more effectively. Another place where leeches are used medicinally is in plastic surgery. People that go in and get facelifts, they're pretty vain about their looks, right? And facelifts cause bruising, okay? So what they can actually do is they can actually put leeches around where they cut, have the facelift, and what those leeches do is they suck the fluid that's in the muscle out, and that's basically blood in the muscle is what causes bruising, right? So they can reduce the amount of bruising that they have by using leeches. The third place where they use leeches quite commonly is in professional and large college athletics. Okay, if you get a thigh bruise, how many of you played sports and had like a thigh bruise before? Okay, when you get a thigh bruise, does it hurt? I mean, sometimes you can't walk for days, right? It's hard to work out. So what they'll do is when they get that bruise, it's basically a blood vessel or blood artery that's popped in the muscle. They'll actually put a leech on there. As it sucks the blood out, then you don't have that blood in the muscle, which prevents the muscle from cramping up or tying up. Okay. It's kind of interesting. When I was up at Utah State, one of my professors actually did research with leeches. And he told us, you know, we could get extra credit if we'd come in and feed his leeches for him. And so we went in there and put these big old leeches on your arm, and they fed for about an hour, and everybody just said BS. It wasn't that bad. It was worth the extra credit, at least for me, in that class. Kind of interesting, about 2 years later, I was at BYU getting my master's degree, and I had one of my fellow students in this class call me up, ask me if I wanted to invest in a business with him. You guys will get this a lot with your college friends. And the question is always, what's the business? How much do you want me to invest? You know, kind of those types of things. And he said, well, I'm going to start a leech farm. And I almost laughed on the phone. He says, I'm looking for a $1,000 investment from about 10 investors to get this leech farm going. Well, I politely declined. You know, first of all, $1,000, at least for me when I was in college, $1,000 is like $10,000 to me today. It was a lot of money. Now, in second place, I just thought the idea of a leech farm was totally ridiculous. Well, I actually happened to run into this fellow student in an airport about 5 years ago. Come to find out, he's a multimillionaire now. Okay.
What he does is he rents his leeches to professional athletic teams and big college sports teams. He charges them about $1,000 to rent one. So that was my one chance at being rich. But, you know, colleges like Snow College, they don't use leeches in athletic departments. You know, none of our athletes are worth $1,000. But if you're, you know, if you have LeBron James, you know, and you're paying him $1 million a game, a couple thousand bucks for the leash is not that big of a deal, right?